Hello and welcome to Radio Disclosure. Now, don't touch the dial. You're not going to want to do that. Today, you're going to hear stories about crop circles, cattle mutilation, half cats. Yes, half cats. That's the big city equivalent to mutilated cattle, where the cattle have their organs removed surgically and not a drop of blood left behind. You're going to hear all about this from Emmy Award-winning science reporter Linda Moulton Howe, who files a report on Radio Disclosure this week. And then that's followed by a lengthy interview with Linda as she talks about her career and her path that led her down the road to investigative reporting. This is a lady that won a scholarship from Stanford University and now currently investigates cattle mutilation and crop circles because of the compelling nature of these subjects. Stay tuned. It's all coming up right here on Radio Disclosure.
As a shortwave radio listener, you know there's no such thing as a good indoor antenna. If you're looking for an antenna that allows you to pull in those distant signals and also gets rid of the atmospheric noise, you need a good outdoor antenna. But in a lot of cases, folks can't have an outdoor antenna. Now you can. Transworld Antennas is the name of the company. The website is transworldantennas.com. Go to their site and check out the TW2010 or the 4040 or the 8080 for that matter. These are all antennas that will increase the sensitivity of your shortwave radio. It gets the antenna that receives outside of the indoor environment, away from electrical noise, the pops and cracks and things that go on inside a building. And they hide. The TW2010 just literally disappears wherever you put it. Folks don't see it. And it's a good antenna for your receiver. It's a good match for any shortwave radio. If you're having difficulty pulling in those distant signals, or if you're looking for a portable antenna that you can take with you wherever you go, you want it to be low profile, you want it to be stealth, where you can set it up and nobody really knows it's an antenna, this is the antenna for you. Go to the website, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And get a TW2010, a 4040, or an 8080, whichever model best suits your receiving needs. You'll be glad you did. Transworldantennas.com. Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? You want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, .com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. Something new at Radio Disclosure. We have been collecting items of interest, something that you might want. And once a month, we are going to have a drawing and give away some of these items of interest. Now, if you'd like to get your name in the hat, write us an email. Go to radiodisclosure.com. That's radiodisclosure.com. Shoot us an email and tell us a little bit about yourself, and tell us that you're interested in the items of interest. We're going to do a drawing once a month, and several people that listen to Radio Disclosure are going to get something really cool. We look forward to hearing from you. Go to our website, radiodisclosure.com, and send us an email. And keep listening and tell your friends about Radio Disclosure. And now, ladies and gentlemen, on Radio Disclosure, Emmy Award-winning reporter Linda Moulton Howe with her Earth Files report on Radio Disclosure this week.
A press release dated June 25th, 2009, was released on the Internet and contained this startling quote by retired United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt, quote, "I wish to make it perfectly clear that the UFOs that I saw were structured machines, moving under intelligent control and operating beyond the realm of anything I have ever seen before or since. I believe the objects that I saw at close quarter were extraterrestrial in origin, and that the security services of both the United States and England were and have been complicit in trying to subvert the significance of what occurred at Rendlesham by use of well-practiced methods of disinformation." Close quote. That press release came from Gary Heseltine, a British police officer and longtime UFO researcher. Colonel Holt's unexpected assertion is about the extraterrestrial origin of what he and his military team encountered in the British Rendlesham Forest near RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge Air Bases in the early morning of December 28, 1980. Gary Heseltine, 49 years old, was born and raised in Scunthorpe, Lincolnshire, England, until age 23, when he joined the Royal Air Force in police security. He served for 6 years until 1989, and then left to work for the British Transport Police. There are 43 county police forces in England, Scotland, and Wales, and there is one national police force that polices the railway network in the United Kingdom. For the past 15 years, Gary has served as a plainclothes detective constable in the Criminal Investigation Department. Gary sought out police work because of an experience he had when he was 15 years old, living in his hometown of Scunthorpe, England.
My interest began when I was 15. I saw a UFO, for want of a better word, a light in the sky that seemed to trigger a number of power grid failures. All the lights went out, which are often attributed to UFOs. And that incident created the interest in the subject for me, which has stayed with me. So for the last 34 years, I've been very interested in the subject of UFOs, and so much so that by the time 2001 came around, I wanted to become an active researcher. The problem was that as a police detective, if a rape occurs, your time is never much of your own. You know, you can work for hours and hours and hardly be at home. And basically, I had to come up with something that I could research, but it would have to be on my own because of the hours and the nature of the job that I worked. And one day, I came up with the idea of police officers. I'd read about one or two police officers in several books, and I began to speculate that police officers have probably seen many, many strange things, but they've never had an outlet or a mechanism to allow them to come forward. And so I created what is called the PRUFOS Police Database, which stands for Police Reporting UFO Sightings. I started off with a half a dozen sightings involving a dozen officers, and after 7 years of research, I've now got 300 reports dating back to 1901 involving over 700 British UK police officers. So it's grown a hell of a lot.
Gary Heseltine says that one of the most startling reports came from Police Constable Alan Godfrey in 1980, who watched a diamond-shaped aerial object suspended in the air above a road in Todmorden, West Yorkshire. Policeman Godfrey tried to turn on his police radio to call for help, but the radio was strangely dead. Then he got out of his police car, but was blinded by a bright white light. Policeman Godfrey's next conscious memory was finding himself back in his car, mysteriously moved to a different location down the road, and the white light was gone. Haunted by the encounter, Policeman Godfrey sought hypnosis. What emerged was his description of being on a spacecraft with small non-human entities examining his body.
As a result of that, I've become known within the UFO community, and from time to time I'll be asked to take part in various television documentaries. And on one occasion in December 2007, the American History Channel were making a couple of documentaries in the UK, one about police officer sightings, so that's why I was involved. And in the process of talking to their producer, I said, "What else are you coming over for?" And they said, "Oh, we're going to make a documentary about Rendlesham Forest." And I said, "Well, who else is getting involved?" And they said, "Oh, we're flying Colonel Holt across." My interest stems from the fact that during my 6 years in the Royal Air Force, I served on two nuclear bases, one in the UK and one in what was then West Germany, protecting nuclear weapons. And the layout of the bases, of which Bentwaters and Woodbridge was leased from the RAF, was a very similar design to the ones that I'd worked on. And I personally had always suspected that there must have been many more witnesses involved who have yet to be traced. And so I said, "Well, I have this theory because I worked on these kind of bases. You know, is there anywhere I could come down?" And they said, "Oh, that sounds interesting." And I spent 3 days on the documentary down at Rendlesham, and during that process, spent a lot of time with Colonel Holt, who I'd never met before.
What year and month?
That was December 2007.
So you were there at the same light and time, basically, as the original event of December 26th to 28th?
Well, I think that was the idea of the History Channel.
Could you jump to the most recent 2009 release from you concerning a film that you are now working on and that you could read for me now, the statement from Colonel Holt?
Yes. Just before I do that, I want to make this perfectly clear that at this moment in time, a film is not being made. What I have done, having met Holt some 19 months ago, is I asked him during that 3 days visit, had anybody ever tried to write a film script about Rendlesham Forest? And he said no. And I said, "Well, I sort of do like to write. Would you allow me to write it, research it, and collaborate with you on it?" And he said there and then, "Yes, I'll help you in any way I can." So basically what happened is I then went away for about 4 months and researched all the known documentaries, books, articles that had been put out about the events at Rendlesham, and created, again using some of my detective acumen, a very detailed timeline of the events from literally the first night through to the point at which he sends off the Holt memorandum to the MOD. And then I went back to Holt and began asking him question after question after question. And that's what happened perhaps for the next 15 months until we got to a stage where the first draft was complete. And then I put it to him and said, "Look, you know, what do you think?" He didn't get it till December of 2008 when he got the first version, the first draft. And he read it, and he said that was great, and he loved it, and that he would fully endorse what was written. And since Christmas, we've been adapting it and tweaking things, as you would do with any film script. So what we have is a film script which is available to meet with film producers, etc. And that was the idea of putting out the press release, to announce that there's been a collaboration between Colonel Holt and myself, and that we now have a workable film script that I believe is crying out to be made into a feature film. You asked me to read the quote?
Yes.
Right. The press release that was put out the 25th of June, which was agreed and which Colonel Holt is very happy to go out with, he said, make it perfectly clear that the UFOs I saw were structured machines moving under intelligent control and operating beyond the realm of anything I have ever seen before or since. I believe the objects that I saw at close quarter were extraterrestrial in origin, and that the security services of both the United States and England were and have been complicit in trying to subvert the significance of what occurred at Rendlesham by use of well-practiced methods of disinformation. I believe Gary Stript will lift a veil of secrecy about what really happened at Rendlesham, events that were and still are of tremendous defence significance to the United Kingdom and indeed the rest of the world.
In 1942, the British Royal Air Force constructed an airbase between Butley and Tunstall in Suffolk County, England, on the northeastern edge of Rendlesham Forest. It was called RAF Butley, about 4 miles northeast of RAF Woodbridge. The Rendlesham Forest was enlarged in the 1940s to help shield military activities. To the south was the RAF Bodsey Chain Home Radar Station that during World War II monitored the launch of V-2 rockets from Germany. Although there was no defense against the V-2 rocket, RAF Bodsey was able to provide the British Bomber Command with the location of the V-2 launch sites, which could then be attacked. East of Butley at Orford Ness, an experimental Madre over-the-horizon radar station was constructed in 1961 to monitor Soviet launches. After the end of World War II, RAF Butley was renamed RAF Bentwaters by Britain's Ministry of Defense and leased to the United States Air Force for its 81st Fighter Interceptor Wing and the 67th Aerospace Rescue and Recovery Squadron. By 1958, RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge became a joint U.S. Air Force and Royal Air Force complex with the big, thick Rendlesham Forest in between. In 1992, after the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Cold War thawed, the United States canceled its involvement with RAF Woodbridge and RAF Bentwaters. The historic RAF Bentwaters is now a privately owned business park, while RAF Woodbridge is used by the UK Ministry of Defence for Army training exercises. What exactly did happen between midnight on December 26, 1980, to 5 a.m. on December 28, 1980, in Rendlesham Forest that provoked U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt and Airman First Class John Burroughs to describe lights in the Rendlesham Forest as alive and speaking to them telepathically on December 28, 1980. Those words were used by John Burroughs in a 1988 hypnosis session to describe his and Colonel Charles Holt's impressions of the lights. There were even rumors that Burroughs jumped on a craft or was taken up in a beam of light. As the clock was about to change from Christmas Day 1980 to midnight December 26, 1980, 20-year-old Airman First Class John Burroughs was on security police duty at RAF Woodbridge's back gate, commonly known as the East Gate. With Airman Burroughs was Staff Sergeant Bud Steffens. RAF Woodbridge was 4 miles west of RAF Bentwaters. Sometime after midnight, Sergeant Steffens and Airman John Burroughs saw strange, colorful lights hovering at treetop level in the Rendlesham Forest east of the gate. So Burroughs and Steffens drove their patrol car out the East Gate on a road along Rendlesham Forest. The colorful red, orange, and blue lights in the clear night sky seemed closer than before. Suddenly, a large white light appeared moving along the edge of the forest, as if pacing their car, and it seemed to move even closer to them. Later on, Airman Burroughs submitted a handwritten statement about what he saw to the RAF Bentwaters Deputy Base Commander, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt. You can see the statement written by John Burroughs and his sketch of the mysterious Rendlesham aerial lights at earthfiles.com. Go to www.earthfiles.com and click on the hot link to 1980 RAF Bentwaters lights and craft were extraterrestrial in origin. With John Burroughs was Staff Sergeant James W. Peniston, the duty supervisor at RAF Woodbridge on that night of December 26, 1980. According to notes in Sergeant Peniston's notebook and his official written report, he and Airman Burroughs got to the center of Rendlesham Forest, and then Peniston wrote in his statement, quote, "When we got within a 50-meter distance, which is about 150 feet, the object was producing red and blue light. The blue light was steady and projecting under the object. It was lighting up the area directly under, extending a meter or two out. At this point of positive identification, I relayed to Sergeant Coffey, positive sighting of object, color of lights, and that it was definitely mechanical in nature," close quote. Peniston also said that the air was filled with electricity, like static, quote, "You could feel it on your skin as you approached the object. There was also a sense of slowness, like time itself was an effort. I got to within 10 feet of the craft in the clearing where it sat," close quote. Sergeant Peniston estimated the craft to be 3 meters long at the base and 2 meters high, or about 10 feet long by 7 feet high. No landing gear was apparent, but the object seemed raised up as if it were on fixed legs. Peniston said he walked right up to the craft and noticed the fabric of the shell was like a smooth, opaque black glass. He said, quote, "No animals were even making noise anymore. The nearer we got to that thing, the more uneasy I felt. It was as if I were moving in slow motion," close quote. You can see Sergeant Jim Peniston's statement and his drawings of the triangle-shaped, dark, glassy surface craft at www.earthfiles.com. 2 nights later, on December 28, 1980, after midnight, John Burroughs felt drawn back to the Rendlesham Forest and encountered lights again. This time, RAF Bentwaters Deputy Base Commander, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Halt, was in the forest with a tape recorder, light alls, and other equipment to document the persistent and unusual light phenomena. Colonel Halt said on the tape recording of December 28, 1980, quote, "Now we're observing what appears to be a beam coming down to the ground. This is unreal," close quote.
We'll be back with our guest Linda Moulton Howe on Radio Disclosure right after this. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Trans World Antennas TW2010 and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Trans World Antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these. If not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. Transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. Transworldantennas.com. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080. 80 and look forward to Dayton. Something new at Radio Disclosure. We have been collecting items of interest, something that you might want. And once a month, we are going to have a drawing and give away some of these items of interest. Now, if you'd like to get your name in the hat, write us an email. Go to radiodisclosure.com. That's radiodisclosure.com. Shoot us an email and tell us a little bit about yourself, and tell us that you're interested in the items of interest. We're going to do a drawing once a month, and several people that listen to Radio Disclosure are going to get something really cool. We look forward to hearing from you. Go to our website, radiodisclosure.com, and send us an email. And keep listening and tell your friends about Radio Disclosure. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our guest, Emmy Award-winning reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
British transport policeman Gary Heseltine confirms that in the early morning hours of December 28, 1980, Colonel Hall did see a white beam of light come from a bright, unidentified aerial object and aim downward to the RAF Bentwaters weapons storage area.
Hall corroborates this. He said that over three radio channels that he was monitoring whilst he was out with his troops and as they were en route back, he could see that a UFO was shining a beam down into the weapons storage area. And the script will deal with that aspect as well.
Is that confirmed by the radar tower watcher?
Well, I don't have his details so I can communicate with him. This is on the basis of what Holt is telling me, the communications that that person has had with Holt. But what Holt is significantly saying once and for all is that he was monitoring three radio channels and heard the person in the tower confirming over the radio that beams were being shone down as he watched into the weapon storage area. Now, that's a very significant thing for him to say. We had a situation where we had a strategic base where many numbers of Air Force, US Air Force policemen were involved in guarding a weapon storage area.
That was nuclear.
Which I believe was nuclear. And the reason why I believe it was nuclear, Holt will never give you that definitive answer on that, purely because of his Air Force allegiances. But having worked on two UK bases, if it was conventional weapons, non-nuclear, on an Air Force base, there would be very few, if any, Air Force policemen guarding that facility. On the weapons storage area, Bentwaters and Woodbridge, there were 14 US Air Force policemen guarding that facility, and there was a whole host of mobile patrols ready to respond to any kind of threat. In total, there were 38 officers and airmen involved at the Bentwaters site. I leave it for you to draw your own judgments.
Right, and it means it needed high security, and that's what always has gone with nuclear weapons storage.
Correct. And that's where my interest initially came from, because I'd been involved. They did, at Bentwaters and Woodbridge, exactly what I did in the Air Force. And one of the key people is this person in the tower on the weapons storage area at Bentwaters and Woodbridge. Yeah? The simple reason is, in 1980, that high tower would have been way above all of the surrounding trees. It would have had a total 360-degree view, unobstructed. The trees would not be allowed to be at the level of anywhere near that tower. And I've been up in those towers. And in fact, when we made the History Channel program, one of the things that I said was, I want to go with Holt up to that tower and see if he will talk about other witnesses. And when we did go up there, he did talk about another witness that had been in contact with him, but he wanted to remain anonymous because he had seen how much interest there had been from any of the witnesses, the Penistons, the Burroughs, the Commands, etc.
And Gary, assuming that that tall tower was there because there were nuclear weapons stored underground and they had 360 degrees clear vision of everything that was happening in Rendlesham Forest, what do you have on the record of what was said from that tower operator during those three nights?
There are scenes within the script that show that the person in the tower would have seen anything that was going on in the distance, would have been consulted with by senior officers who would have said, take a look outside, because he was in a high vantage point.
Why do you think that it took nearly 30 years for Colonel Hault to say to you, quote, I believe the objects that I saw at close quarter were extraterrestrial in origin?
In a sense, that's down to me, because I've said to Hault, if we're going to do this, there's no point in you telling me things if we are not going to have ultimately a definitive statement from you. After 29 years, I would like a definitive statement from you about your recollections on what you saw, and I think we need it to announce this to the press and obviously to create a stir, which hopefully it is doing. And he has reflected upon that, and he has come out with those words. He is fully supportive of everything that I've done at every stage of the collaboration process. I have asked him questions, he has come back. I have asked him further questions, he has come back. And then when it got to the stage of nearing completion at Christmas, I said, look, it's took a lot longer than I thought, but here is the first draft. I want you to change anything that you're not happy with. Let me know what you think. And after Christmas, he came back and said, excellent, one or two little things here and there, minor little tweaks, and then we've gone from there. And he is aware that people will say, why now do you make this kind of definitive statement? And the answer is because I pushed him into saying, well, if that's what you really believe, then that's what you have to put out. Because I don't think you can be wishy-washy on this. You have to go with your genuine beliefs and pin them out there. And he has come back and he's happy to do so. And we have the quote.
Gary, where is Colonel Hault now and what does he do?
He's now retired somewhere, in Washington State.
If there are many eyewitnesses to events in the Rendlesham Forest near Bentwaters, December 26th to 28th, 1980, and if some of those eyewitnesses who were working in the military feel that Colonel Hault's particular timeline may not be absolutely correct, would you consider the possibility of talking with these other people to include perhaps some of their perceptions in this film?
Well, as a police officer and researcher, I want this to be as accurate as possible. Now, there are some inconsistencies from numerous people. However, the consensus of events are that in the Hault memorandum that Hault wrote to the MOD, he got the date wrong. Not two ways about it, he got the date wrong of the first night. So he has clarified within the script, and it's now a general consensus, that the first night's events were the early hours of Christmas night into Boxing Day. The Peniston and Burroughs Cabanza going out into the woods.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear this, that he has now conceded that was an error and now puts him on the same page with the others.
I would not be doing my job if I didn't say, well, hang on a minute, this doesn't seem to ring right when I'm doing my research. Is there any way you could have made a mistake? Especially when you tied it in with the police messages, when the UK police turned up and things like that. It was clear that there was a mistake and that the first night was Christmas night into the early hours of Boxing Day. He now accepts that. So that is the first night. Some people, and I know Burroughs will go with this, that he believes there was something that happened 26th in the 27th.
Right.
But not many people say that, as far as I can see. So the next main night is 27th into the 28th. And this is when, on the 27th, Hault is at Woody's Bar, social function, when he is informed the lights are back. And he then puts together a small team to go out into the forest, to go to the landing site to do measurements. They're trying to get light poles out there, and they do the measurements. They've got the starscope, image intensifier. They find the broken branches. They find the small blast area. They find the triangular markings, the depressions in the hard ground. And then the red winking light that's now become linked with Holt is seen, and then begins this move away from the landing area and a chase or a walk through the woods following this winking object, winking like an eye that appears to be dripping molten metal, but no molten metal can be found. They go off to the farmer's field. Now, this is an interesting thing, and this is something that is never really dealt with once and for all. As a police officer who have worked on many incident rooms, if we were to analyse and rerun Rendlesham, if it had been run as a police incident, somebody would have come up and said, well, they just saw a lighthouse, okay, which is one of the classic sceptical arguments put forward. Well, here's my counter to that. I stood at the edge of the farmer's field with Holt and members of the US History Channel program, and as we looked out at the farmer's field, there was the farmer's house that is referred to by Holt with the object casting a glow into the window because it was so close to the farm. Now, he described the object as being a couple hundred metres away to the left of the farmhouse from where we were stood in broad daylight. He pointed out across, there's the farmhouse, pretty much directly ahead. And then to the left of it, he said, was this object low in the farmer's field, glowing, shining, a reflection into the window of the farmhouse. It almost looked like it was on fire. So there we have Holt stood next to me and the US History Channel crew saying to the left of the farmhouse was this glowing object, literally 15 feet above the farmer's field, a clear, unobstructed view. And then he said, oh, now look to the right, way on the horizon. That is where the Orford Ness Lighthouse is. To the right of the farmhouse, way off in the distance, and in broad daylight, you couldn't see it. But on a night, you would have seen it. But the point is, the object he saw, 200 metres in darkness, strange objects, clear, unobstructed view across the farmer's field. The object is low to the ground, left of the farmhouse. He can see beacon light of the Orford Ness Lighthouse way on the horizon to the right of the farmhouse. So let's get this one thing clear. Once and for all, it was not the lighthouse that Holt saw.
Right, and he is a colonel who was in charge of a lot of men in Bentwaters Woodbridge.
He was the deputy base commander.
Yes, as deputy base commander, to even hypothesize that he would have confused a lighthouse in an area where he had been working for a long time with something that he and other men were chasing through a forest, I've always thought was ridiculous.
Well, it has always been ridiculous, but I do believe this is where the media as a whole have played a very important part in downplaying this entire subject, including the Rendlesham saga, for the simple reason is that literally every documentary I've ever seen being made, whether it be US, Japanese, German, or the UK, everyone has played a lot of airtime to the lighthouse theory. And it contradicts what the men who were involved said. And that is ignoring the evidence, the testimony of multiple witnesses. Look at the first night, Penistone and Burroughs, Cabanza. Cabanzac gets put out as a relay. When the radio starts to fade, he is left behind to act as a relay. And it's Penistone and Burroughs that go forward. They see a landed object. Penistone goes around it. Is that the lighthouse? It's ludicrous. But all the media, whether it be newspapers, TV, documentaries, have always given this lighthouse theory a lot of airtime. And I believe that is a deliberate ploy by some aspects of the media to downplay the significance of this sighting and many others.
Gary, isn't it possible that the lighthouse was actually planted and promoted by people at Bentwaters, both American and British, who wanted to deflect media attention on what they knew was a highly important series of events over at least three nights that, quote unquote, affected national security?
That is the whole point, and this is what Holt is saying. Now, Holt is saying, why has nobody ever interrogated me? Why did I feel as if I'd been kept out of the loop? And it's his belief, rightly or wrongly, but it's his belief that because of his seniority in rank, that there was a deliberate decision made by the security services to exclude him from that process because of his high rank. And therefore, he has remained pretty much left alone.
What is your own perception now on what came up in the Jim Peniston hypnosis in his own effort to recover what had happened to him under sodium pentothal in his early 1990s hypnosis session, trying to recover what the military hypnosis had been in 1980? In that transcript that I deal with in Glimpses Volume 2, High Strangeness, he refers to the beings in the craft, the intelligence having to do with the lights in the craft in the Rendlesham Forest, as being time travelers coming far back in time, perhaps as far back as 40 to 50,000 years, in an effort to use genetic material from the Earth for, quote, band-aids, close quote, in a huge problem that the future time travelers are trying to solve.
When you say to the general public and talk about time travel, that's probably on a par with talking about abductions for most people who are not following the subject. Obviously, he was regressed. These memories have come out. But in the end, we will never know how accurate those are. I think from my point of view, as a police detective trying to delve into this subject, I have tried to stay away from those kind of aspects where we will simply never know. And what occurs is that Jim Peniston was given sodium pentothal and was interrogated. He saw an object, he recorded it in his pocketbook, he walked around it, he touched it, he submitted the photographs. They came out, some people would say, mysteriously fogged. One of the things that's very interesting about that first night with Peniston and Burroughs is that once they go off and they leave Kabanzek behind to act as a radio relay, that when they eventually come back, having seen the object on the ground, it rises, it disappears. They then go try to search for it, and eventually they see a beacon light in the distance, what turns out to be Orford Ness Lighthouse. They had walked towards it after the object had gone. They tried to find the object again. They think they see the same light again. They walk towards it, perhaps a couple of miles. They then determine, no, we've got close enough. We know what that is. That's a beacon light from the lighthouse. And they then turn around and go back towards the base. Now, significantly, when they get back in, and it is covered in the script, some people said, you've been gone for 3 hours.
That's right. Missing time.
The timeline allows for the possibility that to them it was an hour or 2 hours, but maybe it was 3 hours. They could not explain it. And this is maybe where the aspect of regression and missing time and the abduction element may well be true. What I tried to do is stick to the factual elements of the story. Obviously, Hulk is a major player to evolve in a very close encounter with UFOs. And whether he likes it or not, one of the first things I said to him, I said, you may have had a very distinguished career in the U.S. Air Force. I says, but unfortunately, whether you like it or not, you are going to be remembered as the man who wrote the whole memorandum. And the reality is that it was a major event. And there are clear admissions by many of the players involved that they were interrogated. And the reason why they were interrogated seems to me obvious. From somebody who has been in the Air Force, the many, many occasions when politics and the military get involved in downplaying anything, whether it be 9/11 or anything like that, If people want to put out a false version, it can be done. These methods have been used widely by the security services. So to me, it would seem logical that somebody in the security services made a decision. How can we downplay the significance of these first two events? Peniston and Burroughs first night and the Holt team going out on two nights later. Literally, this could be the case that it's a house of cards and everything falls down and we've got to admit, hey, we've been lying to you for many, many years.
About extraterrestrial interaction.
About extraterrestrial visitation.
We're talking about a phenomenon that our government and the British government have a policy of denial in the interest of national security and have had since World War II.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And that means that when an event like Bentwaters occurs, there are procedures in play to misinform the public and the media to keep them at bay and to reinforce the ridiculous explanations, because our government has learned for a long time that if you use even the word hoax or you come up with any stupid explanation, the public and the media in the vast majority will accept it without any investigation, including the New York Times. Now, this leads me to, if you were John Burroughs, and you had the kind of repeating dreams that he has, if you were haunted by what he is convinced is suppressed information inside of his very mind, and he wants it out, and in the hypnosis that we have done so far, he is talking about he and Peniston are dealing with blue lights that they refer to as talking to them telepathic lights. And at one point, Colonel Holt himself talks with Burroughs about the lights that communicated with them. That means that those possible 3 hours of missing time, the hypnosis sessions that have said that people in the tower looked at John Burroughs and said, "We got a report that you either jumped up on this craft or you rose up in a beam of light." Is it possible that John Burroughs was taken and that today, finally in 2009, we might be close to a breakthrough in hypnosis in his mind, and that he may or may not hold the key to what exactly was the source and the agenda of these interactors in the Rendlesham Forest in December 1980 that Colonel Holt now, 30 years later, says were, quote, extraterrestrial in origin, close quote?
Who knows? The reality is that there appears to be a genuine question that they could have been gone for 3 hours, which does not sit with either of them very well because they did not feel they'd been away for that length of time. Both gone under hypnosis and both have come out with accounts of interactions with beings or whatever. If it can be corroborated, great. But whoever gets hypnotized, whoever comes out with an account, in the end, it's an account. Yes, they may corroborate each other under hypnosis, but in the end, it is a strange account, which I'm not saying is not true. But what I'm saying is that what I'm trying to do with this story is tell it from the most factual consensus point of view, so that if and when this film is ever made, it will reach a much wider audience than just the people who are interested in the subject.
Do you speculate in your film script about why there would have been such an enormous cover-up for the last 30 years by both British and the American governments?
There was a cover-up of some kind. Now, I thought that before I met Holt, and obviously having collaborated with him for 19 months, he has given me a much deeper insight into his beliefs. And he has said many times that he believed that the security services were involved in trying to put out disinformation. And I think what he's saying is that by the disinformation, there are many aspects of Rendlesham that a lot of people can't agree on. And his take on that is that certain airmen, not just one, several airmen, were interrogated and fed false information to say things that might not necessarily have happened, but they believed that they had happened. and it was done to downplay the significance of the first night, which was principally Penistone and Burroughs. And then two nights later, when Holt and four others led a forward party following an object through the forest, having been examining the landing site from 2 days earlier. Yes, I personally do believe that it's something that the British and Americans are capable of, because history tells us that in literally every other sphere of politics, that if something needs to be hidden, then it can be hidden. If something needs to have disinformation, then disinformation can be put out there. They are well-worn techniques, not just necessarily that apply to the UFO community. So I genuinely believe that there was a conspiracy. There are many wild aspects to the case, and I don't think we're probably, even with the script that we have now, I still don't think we really know any more than 75% of what's occurred. But what is clear is from many of the people, they were interrogated. So that is a fact. That seems to be a consensus fact, that there was some kind of interrogation process by the U.S. security services.
At my news website, www.earthfiles.com, you can see a copy of the January 13th U.S. Air Force Colonel Charles Holt memorandum about the extraterrestrial phenomenon in the Rendlesham Forest. In addition, at earthfiles.com, there is also a copy of an alleged UK Ministry of Defense memorandum that includes these sentences. Quote, interestingly, OSI reports that the entities were approximately 1.5 meters tall, wore what appeared to be nylon-coated pressure suits, but no helmets. Tape recordings were made on which the entities are heard to speak in an electronically synthesized version of English with a strong American accent. Similar transmissions intercepted irregularly by NSA since 1975. According to OSI, entities had claw-like hands with three digits and an opposable
thumb. If you like hearing the Earth Files report on Radio Disclosure, be sure and drop Linda Moulton Howe an email. She wants to hear from you. Her email address is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. That's just simply earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Be sure and drop her an email and let her know you're listening to her Earth Files report on Radio Disclosure. That's earthfiles@earthfiles.com. In addition, Linda's website is just simply earthfiles.com. That's earthfiles.com. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Trans World Antennas TW2010 and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Trans World Antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these. If not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. transworldantennas.com.
Since the beginning of time and across the history of radio broadcasting, there's only one radio station that has ever earned a full-length documentary dedicated totally and completely to its rise to a pinnacle never before achieved by any radio station, and its fall. This is a story of what happened when the most legendary programming genius of all time takes the reins of an obscure Canadian radio station in the small city of Windsor, Canada, and creates a radio legend that rocked the Motor City, the USA, and half a continent.
Well, that does it for Big Tom Rivers, 1971, and Hank O'Neill. Starts a brand new year next at CKLW. For the last time this year, I will say to you, rock on, Bubba! Ladies and gentlemen, the beat goes on.
CKLW.
2020 news guys, they were disc jockeys without music. Bum, bum, bum. And everybody knew that something was going to happen. You knew something was going to happen.
Motor City Mayor Roman Gribbs has a mad on for an unidentified rapist, a butcher knife-wielding pervert, cornered a secretary in the elevator at Detroit City County Building, and rode her to a vacant seventh floor and proceeded to sexually assault her. Guards are now being considered for future surveillance of the crime-stained seventh floor. Lee Marshall, 2020 News.
Now, Markham Street Productions takes you there as you relive the rise and fall of
the Big HCKLW, the Motor City.
You can now own your own copy of this new DVD documentary, Radio Revolution, the Rise and Fall of the Big 8 from Markham Street Productions. The special edition DVD of this award-winning feature-length documentary includes extra scenes, outtakes, photos, and special features. Radio Revolution, the Rise and Fall of the Big 8 is now available for only $29.95 plus shipping. Go to RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com. Order now while supply lasts. RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW. The Motor City.
Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? You want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, .com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. Something new at Radio Disclosure. We have been collecting items of interest, something that you might want. And once a month, we are going to have a drawing and give away some of these items of interest. Now, if you'd like to get your name in the hat, write us an email. Go to radiodisclosure.com. That's radiodisclosure.com. Shoot us an email. And tell us a little bit about yourself, and tell us that you're interested in the items of interest. We're going to do a drawing once a month, and several people that listen to Radio Disclosure are going to get something really cool. We look forward to hearing from you. Go to our website, radiodisclosure.com, and send us an email. And keep listening, and tell your friends about Radio Disclosure.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our guest.
I want to ask a question.
Emmy award-winning reporter Linda Moulton Howe,
that you were going to be investigating this subject material. Something drove you to it. You were. I'm going to do this. Okay. And for the folks that don't know Linda, when Linda makes her mind up, she's going to do something. It's going to get done. Okay. Now, you know, you're suspecting these things. You're thinking these things. This stuff's going through your mind. you arrive on a scene and you see some of this for absolute firsthand, and a law enforcement official says to you, this is being done by something that is not of this earth, what was the first thing that went through your mind? How did you reckon with that?
I'll admit it. I felt fear. And I remember the moment as if it was a second ago. It was the vacuum cleaner shop where Sheriff Tex Graves in Logan County, Colorado, had retired. He left the sheriff's department and he was managing a vacuum cleaner shop. And when I began my documentary for the CBS station in Denver that became A Strange Harvest, I was at the very beginning stages of interviews in September of 1979, and I called the Logan County Sheriff's Office, where there had been hundreds, literally hundreds of mutilations. Certain counties had many more mutilations than others, and none of us to this day know precisely why the geography that is affected more than in one place than another. Why does that occur? I can't give you a bottom line answer, but Logan County was one of those places. And the sheriff's department said, well, you need to talk with Tex Graves. And Tex is retired now, and he is the one who did all of the early investigations for us. And I drove the 2+ hours from my office in Denver at KMGH-TV up to Sterling, Colorado. And I spent an entire day with former Sheriff Tex Graves in his vacuum cleaner shop. And he had all kinds of files that I just sat there and read. And then he brought out a box. And in that box were, I think, something like 266 color Polaroid photographs. And they were each, how to put this, if there were 112 cases, let's say, and two or three photo averaging per case, he had a nice little rubber band around each case, and each of those rubber band photos matched one of those files that I'd been reading. That's how all this began for me in terms of organizing sheriff's files and photos. And the only place I could do it was on the floor. And I asked him if I could sit down with the files and with the box of photos on his vacuum cleaner store floor. And it was like playing canasta. I don't know, I must have been on his floor for a couple of hours, and I organized all of the photos with the paper and the documents, and it was the first exposure that I had to really studying all of those photos at one time. I absorbed all of those 200 and some photographs, looking at them, reading the files, and Tex Graves, the sun was setting. I'll never forget this. And you know how sometimes, because that was in September, in the fall in Colorado, the sun, when it goes down because of the Rocky Mountains, you can have beams of light that are really intense, and then it gets dark really fast. And the same exact moment that thing happened, that phenomena of it was very bright, and then it went into shadow. And he pulled up a stool, and he was sitting on a stool, and I was still trying to gather up things on the floor. And he lighted a cigarette, and now the cigarette smoke is swirling around his face. The beams of light are just sort of highlighting pieces of him, but most of him is in shadow. And as I looked up at him, it was like a metaphor for everything that I began to live in the animal mutilation investigation, but I did not know that that moment, that scene, those minutes with Tex Graves in the shadow, in the cigarette smoke swirling, and that it was kind of a visual metaphor for everything that I would start on a path that would be very treacherous, very dangerous, very shadowy, and very difficult. I didn't know how difficult then. And when I stood up, and the light was nearly gone, and the cigarette is now the red glow, and he squinted his eyes, and that's when he said to me, "You know, Linda, you know what we're dealing with. We're dealing with creatures from outer space. It's not predator. It's not disease. It's not satanic cult. We're dealing with creatures from outer space." At that moment, Ted, in those shadows, having seen all of those color Polaroids and read all of those documents, and sitting before me is the Logan County Sheriff who handles all of the first investigations for that county, I felt fear. And I'm not a person who feels fear very much. Never have. And I've always remembered that because I realized that in all of my work, I wanted to tell the truth. I truly honor the pressure of fact. I think that it is so important for this world to move away from lies and deceit and corruption to letting the chips fall where they may, as long as everybody is being honest and that reporting goes back to being honest and that we get facts. And in the process of leaving Tex Graves' vacuum cleaner shop and going out to my car and looking up into a now almost twilight sky, where the sky had been my friend my entire life. If my mom and dad were alive, they would tell you that the first thing I asked for at age 3 was a telescope. I loved going out at night. My dad got me a little dinoscope reflector, and I just spent hundreds of nights outside. I loved astronomy. I loved the sky. But when I reached my car that night, and I was looking at the sky that had always been my friend, I suddenly felt nervous. I was nervous the entire ride back to my home in Denver. And because I experienced that adrenaline, fear, and nervousness, I really think it helped me in producing what became the Emmy Award-winning documentary television broadcast, A Strange Harvest, and a few years later, my first book, An Alien Harvest, because I have always tried to report absolutely the facts, but to try to diffuse fear in people. Because if there is anybody on this planet who has been vulnerable in the face of this phenomena, it is me. I have been out in pastures, literally in both hemispheres. I have been all over this planet. I have been out with just myself, nobody else, gathering tissue and plants and soil and thinking, wow, if whoever did this to this animal wanted to come back right now, I wonder what would happen. Well, I've done that and been out so many times in so many vulnerable situations. And I have never encountered yet anything in the so-called UFO phenomena or the unseen or the mysterious plasma lights that I felt threatened by in any way, shape, or form. The most dangerous thing on this planet are other human beings.
Well, you know, I asked the question because I had this feeling that, like so many other folks, that when you begin to investigate something and you finally get to that point where you're staring it in the face, you get the answer that you were looking for, and it was in. And even though that's maybe the answer you were looking for, it's still far more stark than you ever realized when you started doing your investigation.
Well, I just described for you the Alice in Wonderland moment. I didn't go to Sheriff Graves to talk with him because I thought that I was entering into a non-human story. That was not what it was in my mind at all. In fact, I remember when I drove up there, I was thinking maybe this is like the Dugway sheep situation in the 1960s when our government experimented with various kinds of chemicals, and we ended up with, I can't remember how many hundreds of sheep died, and the government suppressed it for a long time, wouldn't own up to the fact that they were responsible for killing all those sheep. I thought maybe this was, that it was some sort of an environmental contamination. Maybe the government was taking this tissue and doing all of this strangeness and not owning up to it because they were responsible. This is why that moment with then former Sheriff Tex Graves, when he's squinting at me and he's saying we're dealing with creatures from outer space, that was a what they call a paradigm shift for Linda Howe. This was that moment where you know that this other human being is telling you the truth from his... As a TV producer and a documentary filmmaker and a reporter, I now am suddenly, in one microsecond, I am plunged into a paradigm shift, and I have to accommodate what is happening inside my own mind, body, and spirit at that moment. Because reporting up until then had been in medicine and in science. That was my beat, and environmental issues. Everything was hard, left-brain fact. And now, what am I entering into? And as the next 9 months, 9 full months, working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, nonstop for 9 months to produce A Strange Harvest. And in the process, the different levels of reaching something that seemed overwhelming, reaching points where I just wanted to give up, that it was too much, it was too complex, it was too confusing, and sometimes, yes, even frightening. But something in me has always been able to balance itself back like a gyroscope. And I would work my way through whatever it was, and the end result is the film, A Strange Harvest, that did receive an Emmy. And then it was in 1989, so it would have been about 9 years later, my book, sort of like the bookend to the TV show, my first book, An Alien Harvest, I produced it because I realized that all over the planet would be newspaper articles or TV programs in which I knew that a police officer or a sheriff or a deputy was not telling the truth about an animal mutilation, and that they were going to the predator disease or satanic cult. And I knew from my own private off-the-record discussions with law enforcement that those were their standby explanations to keep the media and the public off their back. They told me that. So I began to realize that as a reporter, you do have a responsibility that does not end. If you have done an investigation, you have done reporting, you've continued to investigate and report as you could, and you begin to see that the world is being manipulated by political and government forces to go 180 degrees opposite of what you know are the facts. And what you know law enforcement knows is 180 degrees away from the truth. And something in me could not stand by and watch. I had to enter the fray again to try to at least be a reality check on so much misinformation on the animal mutilation phenomena. And that is what Ted provoked me to do An Alien Harvest. And I remember thinking, if this is my letter in the bottle, like the castaways that put the note that goes out to the world, maybe it will reach somebody and maybe it won't. But that's how I started the book, An Alien Harvest. And I have had so many sheriffs and so many deputies, send me notes and letters, say thank you for doing an alien harvest. It is the only book we know that tells the truth.
You know, you are still extremely driven in this area. In other words, you are still investigating. You're still traveling, looking, examining, turning over every rock you can get your hands on.
Right.
I guess my question is have you been able to, it's a twofold question, have you been able to come to any kind of conclusion, or have you reached conclusions that maybe you don't want to talk about?
Oh, there's not a single question in my mind, and there has not been a single question in my mind since I did A Strange Harvest that was first broadcast on the CBS station in Denver on May 28, 1980, 2 hour special. I reported then what I know is the truth today, almost 30 years later, and that is, whether you want to call them extraterrestrial biological entities or non-humans or whatever phrase you're comfortable with, we have interaction by more than one type of another intelligence. It's been interacting with this planet for eons. The mutilations just happen to be one of the more modern manifestations of its presence. And that is the bottom line. Now, I understand what you're trying to ask, and it is a very good question. If I know that non-humans are mutilating animals around the world in both hemispheres and have been doing so for at least a century, maybe longer, and that I am convinced that some humans have also been taken at times in the abduction syndrome by some of these intelligences, some of which would have been involved in the mutilations, because there have been abductions where people, humans, have come back and reported seeing a calf or a cow or a bull or a steer on a craft, and they're being allowed to watch excisions being made, or that there have been interactions between our military in the skies in which we have shot at discs, or the discs have retaliated and jets have disappeared, literally disappeared. We're not talking about blowing up into smithereens. We're talking about whole airplanes have simply disappeared. We don't know where they are. We don't know if they're in another dimension or another timeline. This is, as I'm talking, I'm getting into areas that are very difficult because the planet has not been officially introduced by its political leaders to the main, huge, 3-inch headline, we are not alone in this universe. There are all kinds of other intelligences, and this planet has been a host to several of them, maybe many of them, for a very long time. And for some strange reason, and now we are at the heart of why I keep doing the work I do and want to keep going to my last breath. For some strange reason, somewhere in the last 35,000 to 40,000 years of what is called Homo sapiens sapien, this is the modern man, the truth about our relationship to this universe, to this Earth, to this solar system, and to other life forms took a really bizarre 90-degree abrupt turn in a direction that said, we're completely alone in the universe. How in the world that occurred, I have no idea, but it is wrong. And that means that we have been living on a planet in which cultural institutions, artistic institutions, religious institutions, political institutions, all of it, have built a civilization on a premise that is completely wrong. We are not alone in this universe. Our government knows that. The Chinese government knows that. The Russian government knows that. The English government knows that. Australia knows that. Japan knows that. They all know that. Well, what is it that all of these political power centers, what is it that they know that continues a policy of denial in the interests of national security? What is it? Because you would think that simply announcing, we're not alone, we've been trying to study this phenomena for the last 60 years, we weren't sure in the beginning whether there was a threat, we can now stand in front of you and say we feel that there is no threat from these visitors from outer space, and we are here to try to help you understand what we have learned. That's the press conference that I keep expecting. So there must be other information that governments think that humans cannot handle. That is what I would like to understand.
I guess the main question that crosses most folks' minds, and that is when you're dealing with cattle mutilation, and that is, what could the possible purpose be? Why would an advanced civilization, assuming that that's what they are, benefit or gain in this? Or is it just that there is a process of learning that never ceases, and the cattle are good subjects? Now, the question is, this only happens, I mean, does this only happen in remote areas? I mean, do you hear of mutilations that take place inside of large cities?
Ever heard of half-cat mutilations?
I've heard of those, yes. But, I mean,
yes, it is a long-time phenomenon. Takes place in Vancouver, B.C., Portland, Seattle, Austin, Texas, Falls Church, Virginia, all over Florida. It takes place all over. I think that the bloodless half-cat mutilations are part of the general extraterrestrial biological entity mutilations of animals. And you're asking the question about why, and after nearly 30 years, I would say that everything I've been exposed to, if you said, what is there a bottom line that is perceivable at this point, it would fall into two categories. Food and genetic harvest. Now, there's an encyclopedia of details behind each of those two categories. It would take way too long to go into, but I'll say this. If any listeners are provoked by what I have been talking about, and they really want to know more about your question and what I've been exposed to, this is what I went about as far as I could go in Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1 and 2. And I know how factual some of the material in Glimpses Volume 2 is that cannot be proved because the people who have provided the material did so as long as they would never be exposed publicly. And that it goes, Glimpses Volume 2 goes into the whole issue of why there could be a genetic harvest, not from just this planet, probably from planets all over the universe, having to do with the creation of containers, biological containers, that could do work on a variety of planets and a variety of solar systems, but all under the control and the guidance of something else. And once you start moving into this realm, it's very difficult, but I have found that the further you go, and what I've reported in Glimpses Volume 2 that I know provoked people in Washington, D.C., provoked them enough that I've had people seek me out because they know about this, some of the technologies that are described in the book and the relationship of those technologies to genetic manipulation and harvests of genetic material. And I think it's in that area that the government is highly sensitive about exposing the whole story because they're afraid of the repercussions. But now, let me jump on the other side of that and argue for why I think honesty is always the best policy. The current group of hominids on this planet, dominating the planet, Homo sapiens sapien, have been around in their modern form, I'm talking about like modern day, for about 35 to 40,000 years. And they overlapped with Neanderthals, another kind of hominid. Assuming that there's been genetic manipulation of already evolving primates to create Homo sapien, as I and others have been exposed to in government documents, those phrases, then we already have been a species of Earth life evolving, building, creating, warring, all those things that modern humanity does for 30 or 40,000 years, and the disks in the sky and the mysterious lights and the beams and all of it have been actively woven in the last 35 to 40,000 years, even including pictograms on stone in places as far-flung as Australia, South America, and outside of Albuquerque in the petroglyphs. Meaning, human eyes over these last 40 centuries have seen disks in the sky, have seen beams of light, have seen creatures that did not resemble humans, and they have drawn them in caves or they've carved them on rocks. And we're all still here, and the population is growing exponentially. And we're now at 6.5 billion of this species, headed for 10 billion by the middle of this century. There is no demonstration that whatever set all this in motion and continues to interact with our planet, harvesting genetic material and doing whatever all else it does, has any intent in destroying us or destroying the planet at all. And that gives me even more courage to keep going forward in this difficult field with the idea that any of us who have been exposed to a lot of information from military and intelligence and scientists and so forth, if we can help continue to report some of this difficult material, then maybe this whole planetary population will be able to absorb the first shock. We're not alone in the universe, followed by everything else that will unfold. So writ large, the planet has to go through that momentary shock that I went through in that shadowy light with Sheriff Tex Graves when he said, Linda, we're dealing with creatures from outer space.
Your educational background, obviously, or at least what I have been able to find out, is Stanford University is your educational background. Am I correct?
Yeah, I did my undergraduate work at the University of Colorado in Boulder and had a BA in English literature, cum laude. And then I went to work for about 1 year for United States Senator Len Jordan in Washington, D.C. And I went because my father knew Senator Jordan, but I also thought at the time that I wanted to be a lawyer. So interesting. And I go to Washington, and I'm working for a U.S. senator with the idea that my next step in life is going to be law school. And the Vietnam foreign hearings were taking place right down the hall from Senator Jordan's office, and I would go in and listen. And this is the interesting thing about the moments that affect lives and change your lives. in the hearings on Vietnam, it was the lawyerly people who seemed to be the biggest liars. And that's the truth. In my early 20s, it was as crystal clear as looking at sun through a crystal vase. They're the liars. And the only people in those hearings that I could see were heroes were the reporters. And it was in that strange stew. I'm working for a senator. I'm going down next door and listening in on those hearings. And something in me just clicked over and said, no, you don't want to be a lawyer. You want to be in journalism. And I sent out applications to a bunch of different universities, and Stanford University granted me a full Stanley Boubert scholarship that paid for everything. And when I got that letter, I still can remember the moment. I can see the room I was in. I can read the letter. Oh, my God. Stanford has given me a full scholarship. And I was elated, and I went, and it was fantastic. Two of the best years of my life were making documentary films. That was my focus at Stanford. And we really had to make films. We had to raise the money, write the scripts, cut the negatives, go out and shoot everything, every one of us, each one of us. And I was the only girl in a class of 27 other guys. And in a funny, strange way, it's another one of those characteristics of my life that everything from astronomy and physics to then filmmaking, those were the things, astronomy, that I was really interested in, but I always ended up in groups of all guys. And that's sort of been the story of my life. It was when I went to work as a reporter, I was the only female in a newsroom for a while, and then you work your way through life. And maybe part of that, the fact that I grew up as a 5'2" girl in a world dominated by 6-foot-tall men, but with the same interests as those 6-foot-tall men. And I think it strengthened me over time, because I had to compete on the terms of those 6-foot men. And in a funny, strange way, all of that, all of those years in the beginning where I was going from making documentaries at Stanford, and then I went to work for KNBC News in Los Angeles, got married, and my husband and I went to Boston. He was at Harvard in another degree, and I was doing all the medical programming at the ABC station, and then my husband was hired by Time Inc. and ended up running with another executive some what Ben was new cable, a big cable operation in Denver, Colorado. That's how we ended up in Denver. And I was hired to be director of special projects at the CBS station because they already were broadcasting the programs I was producing in Boston. And it was just like stepping from one room to the other. I was producing all the medical stuff in Boston, and I go to Denver, and the general manager and the program director say, well, you're the one who's producing what we're paying that station here to run, so we'll hire you, and you can do it for us. And I had a wonderful time in Denver producing documentaries, producing live studio programs, doing news segments. And my whole beat was then, as it was at Stanford, as it was in every TV station I ever worked in, my beat was always science, medicine, and the environment. And it's those three big, huge subjects that came to play when I tried to find out what was happening to all of the bloodless, trackless animal deaths known as mutilation.
Well, your story is an incredible one, and it really lends so much credibility to the subject. where folks would dismiss the subject and say, oh, well, that's, and explain it away with a minimal amount of effort, you've gone down the road and have literally turned over every rock. And it makes it even all the more compelling to listen. And the reason for me mentioning the books is I think so many times your books are very, very, the books and the DVDs as well are things that are very much overlooked on your website. And from
they're in the Earthfiles shop.
Well, I think
www.earthfiles.com in the left hand side of the headlines page, yeah, there is the Earthfiles shop, and my books and two DVDs, A Strange Harvest and Strange Harvest 1993, and the four books, they are all there.
You know, I want to say one thing, and that is this: the Earthfiles.com site is a very, very worthwhile thing to join up and be a part of. So if you're listening, you want to go to earthfiles.com and take on the membership and go through and read. I mean, you can get lost on that site, literally lost. You can get lost for days on that site.
It's true. And, you know, Ted, soon I will be up to about my 2000th report representing, I was figuring it out the other day, if you have 2,000 reports that average about 7,000 photos plus documents, then so I'm getting up to 14,000 to 20,000 images and documents, and every single report that I have filed starting in 1999, 10 years ago, every report is archived chronological order, and you can run down all nearly 2,000 of them at one time in the archive, and I use it as an encyclopedia all the time. And it also has this huge Real X-Files section that is material that I have tried over the 10 years to put in there that I think is extremely important. In some cases, I know it's factual, but as I have said many times, Real X-Files is to present material to consider without my being able to prove it. In my science and environment reporting, it's all hard evidence, physical evidence, science, and environment. But in Real X-Files, is some of this hugely difficult material that some of it is quite graphic. I have some Real X-Files with drawings that people in the abduction syndrome that have done that some people who have been subscribers said, this is almost shocking. Well, it's part of the reality of the phenomena. And so I am really, at this point, after 10 years of all of this evolving, I am so glad that I have that Real X-Files section in which I can place material that I cannot prove as a journalist, but that I know as a journalist, we all need to consider even the most difficult parts of this phenomenon.
You know, there's a lot of folks that are on radio and on television that make reports and all kinds of claims, and you can buy books and things. And in most cases, you'll read these things and you become very disappointed because as you dig a little deeper, you begin to realize the credibility of the source is just not there.
Right.
And in your situation, if folks have an interest in this subject, Earthfiles is a great place to go. Because,
I have one, not touting myself, but to just underscore what you're saying, because I really, really work hard at trying to make sure that what I report is substantive, that the podcasts are going to last out there. That's another thing, Earth Files podcast that you help me with so much. I think that they are really important. They are like the Earth Files radio station as well, and that I have to make sure that what I'm going to be putting out there for people to listen to on iPods or that I'm working in images and text, that it's going to have shelf life, that it's going to last, that I have done enough digging and work, and that I'm really, really trying in that regard to make this substantive, to make it like an encyclopedia that people can go to over 10 years and find great value in going back to reports and looking at things that happened 10 years ago. And that was always my goal, and I think that it continues to evolve in that direction. And that means that whatever I'm doing at Earth Files, I am always struggling to report the facts. If the facts change, I will do a report on changed facts. And I think that that is something that is lacking a lot these days in a lot of journalism.
Well, I want to say that the Earth Files site and the entire collection of reports that are there, in knowing Linda, I guess folks don't know Linda like I know Linda, this is one of the hardest working human beings I have ever met in my life. She does not understand what a clock is. When it gets dark, she is still working, and many times when the sun is coming up, Linda is still at it, working on the report that she's been working on all night long. You don't find this kind of dedication in other, I guess I want to say, on other websites, other reporters, and other types of people that investigate these types of things. That just doesn't exist, which makes Earth Files a milestone as far as what it is and what it really stands for. And that's a lot of hard work and a lot of accurate reporting. Now, everything you read on Earth Files, you may find out at some point in time that something up there isn't exactly true. But that's only because the facts were disguised from the reporter. Because Linda does everything in her power to make sure that everything up there is as accurate as it can possibly be. So I'd like to encourage everyone to go to the Earth Files site, earthfiles.com, and sign up. Put in your little credit card number or whatever it is. It's an inexpensive membership, and it is it's just extremely rewarding and fascinating. And help, I would say, you know, I want to say it this way: support the site. Make sure that the site never goes away, because it's a good thing. Now, your books again. Let's go one by one, mentioning these books by name and the two DVDs that you have out, because I want folks to realize that these are there.
All right, and I'll do this chronologically.
They're also great gift ideas, I can tell you right now, because these are not average quality books. This is not something that you go into the bookstore and you pick up, and like she said, you look at a report or a picture or something, and it's blurred and out of focus, and you can't read it. And I mean, these things have had a lot of quality put into them, but go ahead and list these things out chronologically, if you would.
Yeah, and Ted, thanks, because the quality of the photos and the documents that was always really important to me, and I think that everybody has always given me feedback that they treasure these books because the quality of the photos and the documents is so high. The first of my work related to this whole issue of a non-human phenomena was that TV special, A Strange Harvest, that I did for the CBS station in Denver. And that is now available on a DVD at earthfiles.com in the Earth Files shop. You just look for Earth Files shop and click on it, and everything is there, paragraphs about it, critiques and reviews and all of that, and then a way to purchase the books and the DVDs. It's all very straightforward and easy at Earth Files shop. So the first is the DVD, A Strange Harvest, and the next production that I did was my first book, An Alien Harvest, Further Evidence Linking Animal Mutilations and Human Abductions to Alien Life Forms. That was the subtitle. And then, and that's 8.5 by 11 with color photos throughout on really high quality paper. The next book that I did was Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1, Facts and Eyewitnesses. That came out in 1994. And that is a beautiful book. It is exactly what I had hoped to do, expensive to produce, but color throughout, and it goes crop circles, animal mutilations, the human abduction syndrome, and ends up with a fascinating all-color taxonomy of all the various different types of non-humans that people had drawn for me or had submitted to me, ranging from the 1960s up to 1994 when that book came out, having to do with interactions. And a lot of the interactions were completely conscious, out in farmyards, riding a horse, not all of this dark bedroom stuff. And so the drawings that are in that taxonomy in Glimpses Volume 1, I refer to all of the time in that book, and think it's perhaps in some ways one of the best collections, because it is all of the illustrations of so many different people over so many years. And then that went to Glimpses Volume 2, High Strangeness, which came out 4 years later in 1998. And there my emphasis was on the first chapter is called Military Voices. And I had accumulated by then so many extraordinary, on the record, either with or without real names, of military and intelligence people that I felt had to be shared with the public. Everything from all kinds of encounters in Vietnam and Cambodia, other parts of the world, all related to military and intelligence investigations of what they themselves call extraterrestrial biological entities. And that propels the book forward into three more big chapters. It's a four-chapter book. Each chapter is over 100 pages long. So it's about a 456 page. It's a large book. And the second chapter has to do with human abductions, which leads to a third chapter with Jim Sparks, an extraordinary Italian man who has had conscious interaction with non-human entities for a long period of his life, different from most people, not missing time, not zapped out. It was the consciousness and the non-human intelligence trying to teach him math and geometries and all kinds of holographic technologies. And that, it is so detailed with so many drawings and material about languages and symbol and technology that it constitutes a chapter by itself, and it's really quite extraordinary and is held up over time. And a whole chapter on in the human abduction syndrome, having to do again with this issue of containers and life force and how that might be manipulated. So the book, Glimpses Volume 2, is very heavily weighted to the military and intelligence information and what I've learned from people there, but evolves to literally the most complicated and the most difficult and the most profound issues having to do with biological life, how it can be made, and what can be put in it. And then the fourth book, between those two books, I did Strange Harvest 1993. I went to Alabama with a crew. It was a complete and total Linda Moulton Howe Productions documentary for television and video release, and now is another DVD at earthfiles.com. And Strange Harvest 1993 was my going to Alabama, where they were having mutilations all over the place, UFOs, lights, UFOs were being photographed on time-lapse cameras by the editors of newspapers, the police, everybody was involved. It was really something, and I spent quite a bit of time with the crew. We had extraordinary experiences, and everything is in the Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1, about my trip to Alabama, and then I did this documentary also to complement. So the book and that DVD, Strange Harvest 1993, kind of go together. And finally, in 2000 to 2002, I released the book Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, that I wanted to try to share with people in a way from a reporter's point of view, that the crop formations could not be dismissed as Doug and Dave, two elderly gentlemen living in southern England, making formations around the world in 37 countries. Ted, that has always amazed me. The facts in 1991, when the so-called Doug and Dave story went around the world, and I read it with my own eyes, the New York Times on page 2, at the top of the page had an article that said, Crop Circle Mystery Solved. And you're reading the New York Times, and it goes into how these two men, Doug and Dave, they've owned up. They stood in front of a camera in England, and they said, we've been doing the crop formations. And that very summer, that press conference and that New York Times article was in September of 1991. That entire summer, there were crop formations reported literally around the world in both hemispheres, including wet rice paddies in Japan. Complex, intricate patterns. Doug and Dave had nothing to do with any of the global crop formation phenomenon, and yet the August New York Times on page 2 ran with this. And I knew a lot about the crop formations. I'd already been doing interviews. I was working with Paramount Studios in Los Angeles on what became UFO report sightings that led to the sighting series I was producing. And crop formations was one of my subjects, and I knew that this was preposterous. Everybody who had knowledge knew it was preposterous. We could not believe how the public and the media seemed to take the Doug and Dave explanation as if it could even possibly be realistic. Well, between 1991 and 1999, I'd had my own encounters with mysterious lights. I had been in dozens and dozens of night watches and had seen the most extraordinary phenomena. I had looked at videotape of mysterious lights in crop formations, either in the day or the night. I had interviewed people who had seen lights over fields. They hadn't videotaped and they hadn't photographed, but they had watched lights at night come into a field looking through binoculars and had seen crop go down under the lights. All of this was happening. And I wanted to somehow bring into focus what I felt was a truly phenomenal series of events that I think to this day link right back to the same intelligence that inspired the ziggurats, the stone circles, and the pyramids. And that's mysterious lights and crop circles, and the second edition came out in 2002. And since 2002, I have been working so hard at earthfiles.com and radio and doing TV segments that I think that I will do a fifth book. I have one sort of formulating in my mind. It will not be on one subject. It's going to be, I think, a faceted look at where I think all of these phenomena are pushing us humans to go when it comes to a universe that seems to be built quite differently than we were taught when we were in school, and that time travel and other dimensions and wormholes and all of those phrases that are now common to quantum physics are going to start percolating more and more, I think, into the general media and the general public dialogue, because I think that's where all of this is pushing us.
Well, that's incredible. Once again, I want to emphasize the website, earthfiles.com. Be sure and go visit the website. You're off to United Kingdom.
Yep. And rock formations.
Then you're going. Tell us just a little bit about that. I know you have to go. We've been talking a pretty good while. But tell us where you're headed and what the goal is there.
July 23rd, I'm getting on a plane to go to Heathrow that will take me to a car, and I'm going to drive out to Wiltshire. It is a trip I love to take. When you drop down off of the M4 onto this road that goes into some of the most breathtaking farm country on the planet, to think that they have been farming in Wiltshire for 5,000 or more years, the same fields, the same hills that the Celts walked. It is magical. And as you start going through the farm country, as you get past Marlborough, which is the largest town in Wiltshire, that's the county is Wiltshire, I'm going to be headed to the fields that I know already have crop formations in them, and the fields that we are all expecting crop formations to enter after I'm there. And what happens, Ted, is you don't set an itinerary. You just begin. It's the most exciting time because you literally turn your life into a river. It depends on what's happening where. And you don't sleep much at all for 2.5 weeks because you're up on top of Woodboro Hill and Silbury Hill and anywhere that you can go at night where there's a field and there is not a formation. And you watch and you have people that share your passion and you have fantastic conversations while you're looking at lights moving the sky through binoculars, through starscopes, through infrared, and hoping that maybe, maybe some of us might be lucky enough to catch the phenomena in action.
And we'll be hearing from Linda, because as she's making her trip to the United Kingdom, she's going to be telephoning in and talking to us and creating broadcasts overseas.
That's right. That's right. As
it unfolds and as it happens. So we'll have
exactly.
We'll have the firsthand reports right here. And once again, thank you so much. I really appreciate your company. I appreciate you taking the time. Your story is compelling and interesting and intriguing and most definitely exciting, and I'm sure folks enjoy hearing you.
And thank you, Ted, for giving these subjects and a reporter like me the time to talk in greater depth than I normally am allowed or do, and that you ask extremely good questions. And my deepest thanks to your shortwave audience who are out there with good minds thinking and listening, and I look forward to whatever feedback that we can get.
Something new at Radio Disclosure. We have been collecting items of interest, something that you might want. And once a month, we are going to have a drawing and give away some of these items of interest. Now, if you'd like to get your name in the hat, write us an email. Go to radiodisclosure.com. That's radiodisclosure.com. Shoot us an email and tell us a little bit about yourself, and tell us that you're interested in the items of interest. We're going to do a drawing once a month, and several people that listen to Radio Disclosure are going to get something really cool. We look forward to hearing from you. Go to our website, radiodisclosure.com, and send us an email. And keep listening and tell your friends about Radio Disclosure. As a shortwave radio listener, you know there's no such thing as a good indoor antenna. If you're looking for an antenna that allows you to pull in those distant signals and also gets rid of the atmospheric noise, you need a good outdoor antenna. But in a lot of cases, folks can't have an outdoor antenna. Now you can. Trans World Antennas is the name of the company. The website is transworldantennas.com. Go to their site and check out the TW2010,
or the 4040, or the 8080 for that matter. These are all antennas that will increase the sensitivity of your shortwave radio. It gets the antenna that receives outside of the indoor environment, away from electrical noise, the pops and cracks and things that go on inside a building, and they hide. The TW2010 just literally disappears wherever you put it. Folks don't see it. And it's a good antenna for your receiver. It's a good match for any shortwave radio. If you're having difficulty pulling in those distant signals, or if you're looking for a portable antenna that you can take with you wherever you go, you want it to be low profile, you want it to be stealth, where you can set it up and nobody really knows it's an antenna, this is the antenna for you. Go to the website, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And get a TW2010, a 4040, or an 8080, whichever model best suits your receiving needs. You'll be glad you did. Transworldantennas.com. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Disclosure. Be sure and tune in next week, same time, same station, for Radio Disclosure. And a special thanks to our guest, Emmy-winning science reporter Linda Moultonhow. Be sure and write us. Go to the website at radiodisclosure.com and send us an email. That's radiodisclosure.com. Thank you very much for listening. See you next week.